Well, welcome to GoldSeek.com Radio, everyone. On this encore broadcast, we have a medley of top guests lined up for you, including Dr. Ron Paul, Jim Rogers, Mike Maloney, Robert Kiyosaki, and Louis Nabalier. So on behalf of the entire GoldSeek.com crew, including Vanessa, Peter, Chris, and Robert, we want to wish you a Merry Christmas, Feliz Navidad, Happy Hanukkah, and Kwanzaa, and, well, to all of our non-religious friends, don't worry, this too shall pass in about a week. Louis Nabalier joins me with his take on the domestic economy. He's the editor of four leading stock advisory newsletters, including Louis Nabalier's Quantum Growth, Emerging Growth, Global Growth, and Blue Chip Growth. Welcome back, Mr. Nabalier.
It's an honor to be here.
You know, over the past 2 years, the equities markets have outperformed virtually every other asset class. You have been consistently bullish on the sector. What set of factors convinced you that equities were preparing for a run, and where do you think they're headed next?
Well, we're headed off higher through April, largely because of seasonal patterns. You know, markets are just better during the holidays. We have often an early January effect. It starts before Thanksgiving. There's a lot of year-end pension funding and then pension funding in the new year. So we're just kind of hitting that sweet spot for the market. The other thing that's happening is the earnings finally showed up. You know, there were no earnings till the third quarter. In the second quarter, the S&P sales were up 2.1, but excluding financials, earnings were down 1.4. And so earnings are finally showing up, and they're going to improve in the fourth quarter. And so that kind of gives the market its missing ingredient. And then on top of that, we got all that Fed pumping that's still going to go on, because the economy's not hitting on all cylinders. So we got the Fed pump, we got earnings, we got a strong seasonality. Our testing shows that the market is getting more narrow. There's going to be fewer stocks going higher, and that's nothing to be alarmed about. That's just how, as markets rise, they get smart. It's like a race, you know. The longer the race goes, the fewer runners will be leading the race. So the pack's thinning out, and the creme de la creme is rising.
So you expect investors to rotate funds into the hot sectors du jour. The tide may be lifting all boats, but after a while, it's really the top boat, if you will, that wins the race. Well, you know, the FOMC maintained the status quo, as I mentioned, to compensate, I guess, for the blow dealt to the economy by that 3-week-long government shutdown. The Fed could provide the rocket fuel required, I think, to lift the markets, at least into your time frame. Any other comments, then, specifically on the FOMC report?
Not really. Here's the deal, just to kind of cut to the chase. First of all, Janet Yellen's a dove. She's obsessed with the unemployment situation. That's the Fed's mandate, is to fix that. But there's a huge data problem. 70% of all new jobs we're creating in America today are temp jobs. So if somebody gets two temp jobs, that counts as two workers. According to the household survey, a much broader survey than the payroll survey, it covers the cash economy, you know, the gardener, the housekeeper, or, you know, other people might get paid in cash, the underground economy. That's shown over 400,000 less jobs created this year than the payroll survey. Every single employment survey, ADP, Gallup, is showing far less job creation than the payroll report. And there is a real problem with the data. The Fed in previous FOMC meetings has said that we might have to lower their unemployment target from 6.5 to lower. So it's a mess. So the Fed's going to have the pump on until the unemployment's fixed, and that might be 2 or 3 years.
I also wanted to shift gears for a moment into the U.S. dollar market. You know, it fell to the lowest point in almost 2 years versus the euro last week on expectations of continued Fed debt purchases and holding that interest rate policy near zero. Now, investors appear to have factored in continued monetary operations. And as you mentioned, Janet Yellen scheduled, I guess, sometime next month, known for being quite dovish.
Yeah, quantitative easing to eternity, essentially. The dollar is very interesting. The dollar has been in a multi-decade slide. The only reason it rallies is when there's a liquidity crisis. So there was a liquidity crisis in 2008, and when Europe was seizing some Cyprus bank accounts, the dollar rallied. But when all the dust settles, we have lower rates than the rest of the world. There is higher rates That undermines the dollar. Our government shut down, and infighting didn't look good to the rest of the world. And then, of course, President Obama missed an Asian trip. You know, China's there, Russia's there, exerting their influence. No one from the U.S. was there. And obviously, we subbed out our foreign policy to Russia on Syria, and Saudi Arabia's mad at us, and I can go on and on and on. So all these things have contributed to undermine the dollar. Having websites that don't work and things like that doesn't help either. So the more we embarrass ourselves, the more the dollar is going to get weak. But that's a wonderful thing. The weak dollar creates windfall profits for big multinationals. And if I had any complaint about the market a few months ago, it was a strong dollar. So now that the dollar is on a slippery slope, it's wonderful. And that's one of the main reasons earnings are going to continue to improve.
The Chinese agencies in how called for de-Americanization of the global currency, proposing a new international reserve currency. They downgraded, as I'm sure you saw, the U.S. dollar from A to A minus. A trend we continue to see, particularly amid the government shutdown and debt ceiling fiasco. I mean, I really think this has far less to do with shaky web pages and more to do with intense government profligacy. You know, the Fed balance sheet now approaching $4 trillion and likely to put another $1 trillion.
Yeah, based on what they've already pre-announced, will be over $5 trillion, up from $800 billion back in 2008. The Fed monetized 75% of all new debt last year. They own 20% of all the Treasury debt. They own more than China and Japan combined. The Treasury sells the debt, the Fed buys it. We're not fooling anybody else. And Ben Bernanke was put in an impossible situation, so we knew it would be good till he left. Janet Yellen, to be candid with you, is she's a dove that likes her statistics, so I think she'll be very, very precise. One of the reasons the Fed misled the markets this year is they thought the economy was booming. And so back in May when Bernanke dropped his bomb, he had this rosy economic forecast that didn't materialize. So he quickly reversed himself in June. That was a Bernanke bounce. And the Fed just doesn't know how to tap the brake. You know, we're in uncharted territory. We're pumping, Europe's pumping, Britain's pumping, Japan's pumping, and no one knows how to take their foot off the brake. This is going to be fascinating to watch, but at least Janet will be data-driven. It would be nice if the government could have some good data. I mean, the government data we get nowadays is just horrible. I mean, it's not only is it the payroll reports, things like retail sales. They tell you things are horrible at Home Depot and Lowe's, but they have the strongest same-store sales since 1999. So there's a lot of weird stuff in the government data nowadays. I'm one for thinking we might want to buy the government a computer, at least at the Commerce Department, Labor Department.
No, that mirrors my sentiments exactly with regard to data. It's like the computer programming and computer science cliche, garbage in, garbage out. Unfortunately, if our new chairwoman receives ridiculous numbers that really don't reflect the current state of the economy, basing decisions on data, which I don't know many folks who actually even use much government data in their reports anymore. I mean, you can't even run a basic multilinear regression with reliable results.
The seasonal adjustments have gotten to be a real problem. And, you know, I subscribe to independent economists like HFE Economics, Ian Shepherdson, things like that, and they're just all baffled. Yardini's another guy I read. It's almost becoming comical. And there's other things. You know, in the last 4 years, disability claims exceed payroll job growth every month in the last 4 years, except for 3 months. You know, I had an interesting story. I sold one of my divisions, about $1.6 billion under management, so I let some people go. And I said, if you want a job, go work for the people that bought the assets. One of my guys I laid off was a USC football jock. He's got two national championships rings. He's 57, but he works out all the time, goes to the gym, and still benches 340 pounds, and the first thing he does, he goes straight to disability. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with him, you know. So, you know, there's some weird things going on in our economy. The job market is just, I think it's beyond the Fed fixing, to be candid with you.
It certainly looks that way. We're starting to see some frightening statistics, numbers approaching 80 and 90 million able-bodied folks not working, sitting on the sidelines, half of American households receiving some type of federal government assistance, and even those numbers may be tame.
And like down here in Florida, you know, they sign up a lot of seniors for food stamps because they want them to know it's available for them. And they got a quota. They got to sign up 150 people a month. So that's their quota. So if you're not signing up sufficient people.
It's a perfect segue into the next hot button issue here. Friday, November 1st, marks the first official day of food stamp tapering. Now, while it's common knowledge that benefits will decline on average 5.5%, what's not widely disseminated is that many cards will be completely cut off. How many cards? Well, as many as millions. That is an official tally here. Well, there is that little-known work requirement. Congress passed the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1999. There's a mouthful. Which added a work requirement for many folks to obtain stamps. And what this meant was that adults and able-bodied people without dependents must work at least 20 hours per week or be enrolled in a federally approved job training program. And so millions of those folks simply will find that their SNAP cards don't work as soon as Friday. There was also another group of folks whose cards will either not work or be curtailed who were very close to the food stamp limit. Over the past decade, many people who didn't qualify for food stamp EBT cards were given cards because they were approaching the level the government officials, you might say, bent the rules a bit to help them out. Well, they're going to find that cards are not working. So some analysts expect food stamp and EBT riots in America as soon as Friday. I'd like your outlook on the situation, please.
Well, that was the Walmart crisis. You know, they had a little riots in Walmart. You know, I don't have those kind of retailers, so it's not going to bother my particular portfolio. I do have Costco. Costco's really more of a luxury retailer, but you can't have the gravy train running forever. But, yeah, the Family Dollars, the Dollar Generals, the Walmarts, this could be a serious problem for them. We're entering unknown territory.
We certainly are. And I'd like to shift over to the precious metals sector. You know, after 24 difficult months, there are signs that suggest the bull market could be reasserting itself, including gold backwardation, 10 backward dated days in a row consecutively here, as well as we're seeing some improvement in the gold and silver shares. We're seeing a degradation of the U.S. dollar. Plus, as we mentioned, the new dovish Fed chairwoman, rotation of funds away from the generational bond market into stocks and potentially the metals, and extremely oversold sentiment and technical conditions.
As the dollar gets weak, commodity prices go up. So one of the things that was hurting the dollar several months, hurting gold several months ago was a strong dollar. Now that the dollar's weak, it's firming up all commodity prices like gold, silver, everything. Even oil's artificially high right now because commodities are priced in dollars. There's no doubt that gold tried to make a base around 1300, and it's bounced off that base very, very well. On top of that, you know, anytime someone gets mad at a central bank or there's uncertainty in the world, gold tends to do well. There's also continued threats of a South African strike, so we really like platinum. So I think there's a good foundation under gold. I think it's a good time to nibble on it, as well as platinum. But this base building process might go on for a while. And so don't be surprised if it's only at 1400 a year from now. The bottom line is we're actually got in the gold business, I think, since the last time I talked to you. I signed up with a firm that does competitive bidding. They do it for Merrill Lynch and Credit Suisse, and now they do it for us. Why we got in the gold business is not so much we're gold bugs, although we got a lot of great articles on NadlerGold.com because one of my editors is very good at that. So we got a lot of interesting data in there. But why we got in is we're trying to squeeze the spreads. The markup on gold can be quite high. So we have a competitive bidding system so everybody can see what the best bid is. And this is also why I'm in the bond business. I have a $1 billion bond business squeezing spreads. You get a higher yield. So we are trying to help people with their metals investing. And, of course, they can take delivery or store it.
Wanted to ask you about the fiscal deal passed by Congress to reopen the government and circumvent that $16.4 trillion limit on borrowing. Many folks are aware, well, that the issue has passed for the time being, but I think it's less well known that this merely suspended the debt limit. They never actually settled on a limit. There's no dollar amount set as to how much the government can accumulate. In fact, they spent several hundred billion just during that shutdown, we find out later. Although it may seem like an insignificant nuance, I think Americans now have little clue as to how much debt their government is going to be piling up between now and February 7th of next year. I'd like your opinion on this situation.
Well, obviously, this is one of the things that's undermining the dollar, that we always kick the can down the road. I don't think they were so much arguing over the deficit ceiling as just that they have to do something, come up with a grand bargain. And, of course, if they do the famous grand bargain, they're going to do it after the midterm elections. So I don't think anything will get done between Patty Murray and Paul Ryan. But all the shenanigans Jacob Blue was playing on accounting were just shocking. You know, we saw month after month before we hit the ceiling that there was no debt, because he was borrowing from here, borrowing from there. Then he said, I'm running out of accounting tricks. I mean, Jacob Lew is one of the most corrupt, devious people on the planet. I can't stand the guy. You know, he blew up part of Citigroup. He lost $20.1 billion in 2008. He's one of the pioneers of leveraged debt. All of his investors got wiped out of 97% of their money. The only thing that he did better than, you know, the Bernie Madoffs or the Tom Petters or the other people out there is at least he got the government to bail out Citigroup. So as long as Jacob Lew is Treasury Secretary, I would not be bullish on the U.S. dollar. We do have a joke in our business that just because he blew up Citigroup doesn't blow up our economy. But it's a serious problem. I mean, we have a Treasury Secretary that's out of control. He lies in front of Congress.
I'd like to shift over to the delays they're talking about as far as delaying the debt ceiling and threat of further government shutdowns. Whether you think this could portend a Detroit-like national bankruptcy in our distant future?
No, I don't think we'll go that far. I think what makes America a great place is of our 50 states, 30 are pro-business. And we're going to screw up, you know, California or Detroit or other things. But in the end, hopefully somebody will have a better model. And we're a younger society than most. The immigration does work better here than does in other countries. Not that it's perfect. There's plenty of problems. But as long as the United States remains a beacon of the world where people want to come here, they want to go to school here, they want to bring their capital and money here, hopefully we can grow our way out of our mess. Already we have more debt per capita than Europe does. But I think Americans in general are more optimistic. So hopefully we can grow our way out of the mess. But, you know, we do have more people receiving federal aid now than working. Obviously, there's a lot of problems. You know, in California, there's a certain percent of the population, 25% of a certain percent of the population doesn't even have bank accounts anymore, you know. So the joke is, are the check cashing stores that efficient? Or maybe they're part of the cash economy and getting their benefits. So, you know, there's a lot of weird things going on in America. You know, I should not be able to fire high-paid people or lay off high-paid people that I know are men, you know, are just really sharp, and they shouldn't be able to get aid. I mean, in California, you can get disability from acute stress from commuting. There are doctors who sign off you can't handle getting on the freeway anymore, and you get your 900-a-month disability. That's all draining Social Security. So if I was a retired person, I would be alarmed. They have already messed with everybody's inflation-adjusted adjustments. That's called the chain-weighted CPI. They're going to be curtailing those. But hopefully we'll get some leadership from our states, and hopefully maybe one of these governors will lead us out of the mess we're in one day.
Well, to begin with, the California acutely stressed commuters, in North Carolina, we call them telecommuters. We actually telecommute to work.
I'd rather they be part of that, you know, virtual economy than go get disability, you know. Actually, I met your governor, Pat McCrory, when he was mayor of Charlotte. I actually had a friend's birthday party, and he's a very competent guy. I know he's been pushing some people's buttons there in the state, but, you know, he's a pretty competent guy, and I don't know if he'll go to the national stage. I'd say for a politician, he was one of the nicest ones I ever met.
But I'd also like to backtrack a moment to your comments that I thought were quite positive. It was a breath of fresh air with regard to the United States and noting 30 pro-business states. Perhaps people will vote with their pocketbooks as well as with their feet and, you know, make a shift to areas that are more pro-business instead of just giving up on the United States altogether.
Yeah. You know, there's a rumblings that the whole South may be tax-free one day, become all a big tax-free zone from Louisiana to, you know, Mississippi, Alabama, all the way over to South Carolina. Sorry, I don't think I included North Carolina in that. But, so, I mean, you know, and of course, when you do that, you have taxes on other things, and, you know, whether they get from sales or property taxes and things, but the, or vehicle fees and things. But the bottom line is, you know, you know, like when I'm in Chattanooga, they're all happy. They stole Amazon from Texas, you know. So if we've got Tennessee preying on Texas, that's a good thing. You know, I have a business in Reno, Nevada. We prey on California all the time. So it's and the state of Washington, too. You know, like in Reno, Microsoft's the biggest employer in town because they run all their money through Reno, so they don't have to pay a 2% tax in the state of Washington. So on their gross revenue. So then somehow we got Amazon there, another Washington company. And we got, you know, Apple, Oracle, Intel, Cisco. They all keep their treasury there. They escape the California state taxes. And then the Intuit founder is my neighbor. So, you know, it's a big world. And the fact that capital goes to where it's most welcome is refreshing. And, you know, and then, of course, a lot of our companies keep their money overseas because they don't want to repatriate the money because they don't want to pay extra taxes. So, because they've already paid taxes all over the world. So I just think, you know, we'll get somebody pro-business down the road here. You know, the government is not messing with the private sector as much because taxes are capped. I realize if I'm in the health business, I'm being messed with. But outside of that, one-sixth of our economy, you know, the government is hopefully going to stay out of the way.
Well, I hope that any teachers that we have and professors listening to the show will take to heart some of your comments here and remember to try to pass along, although it's politically incorrect today, to your students that it is the business sector that creates the profits that allow government to exist, that government does not produce anything. I think this is something we've forgotten today. I think that starts with our education system. I mean, we really need for our teachers and professors to let everyone be aware of the fact that it may not be the exciting thing to talk about, but at the end of the day, it is the entrepreneur and the big businessman producing the output and creating the jobs, not government.
Yeah, and you know, high school economics is called the velocity of money. It's how fast money changes hands. And if there's uncertainty, we tend to hoard our money and the velocity of money slows down. On the other hand, if we're happy and we're busy spending, the velocity of money picks up. You know, Britain is the best case study of this. They had a heat wave in the summer. That got them out and about spending more. Then Mr. Murray won Wimbledon. That made him happy because he was a Brit. And then they had a new king born, I think Prince George, and so that made them all happy. And their retail sales have exploded, and the economy's booming. I've always had a joke that if Joe Biden became president, it might be good for the economy because he's so funny. Not that he, you know, I'm not talking about his policy, I'm just talking about his attitude. When you go to the voting booth, we want you to vote for not incompetent people, but happy people. I think we learned this last election that as competent as Mr. Romney was, he just didn't get the vote out. So, unfortunately, we have this pop star culture, and it's going to be, I guess we only want to elect pop stars, so apparently Christie thinks he's a pop star. Maybe Rand Paul will get some young people to vote for him. It'll be very hard for the GOP next time because it looks like it's going to be Hillary, and that's a lot. The gal swung last year, the last election, and if Hillary runs, I think he's going to get a lot of the female votes. So it's really in the hands of the women to pick somebody.
No, I'll have to leave the politics to you. That's not my forte. But I will say that we appreciate your comments today, and I'd like for you to, since you seem to have so many irons in the fire here, tell folks what it is that you'd like to share with them with regard to contact information and what's going on with the Navalier empire.
Well, Navalier basically is still known as a good risk-adjusted manager. We're more famous for large cap, where Lipper gives us a 5 in preservation capital. That's the highest rating. But we do dividend management. We do tactical management. We go in and out of the market. We're very good at international management. We did sell our ETF management because we were worried that some of the ETF firms were blowing bubbles under key stocks. You know, the excess valuation you see in Tesla nowadays at over 10 times sales, 440 times forecasted earnings, I would blame the NASDAQ 100, the QQQ, for that. I would also blame equally weighted ETFs or revenue weighted ETFs. And so what's happening out there is Wall Street's creating these vehicles for people to invest in where they are chasing the strongest sales momentum, where they're chasing an equal weight so Tesla gets the same weight as a Ford does. But no one's looking under the hood at the valuations. You know, we don't pay a premium for our growth. I mean, we have better growth in the market, but we don't pay a premium for it. So I think, you know, there is some froth in this market. I'm refreshed that the Tesla CEO, the Netflix CEO, keeps telling their investors that their stocks are overvalued, okay? I think that kind of candor is refreshing. They're also trying to protect themselves against class action lawsuits. But I think as this market goes higher, it's like a party, and it's going to thin out. And you want to be with a creme la creme. You don't want to be with a, you know, this market's getting smart for a change, and so I really like it. And I also like the fact that earnings are getting better.
No, I think it's an excellent assessment with one proviso, and that is if you take a very close look at those quarterly revenues, I'm sure you notice it was something like 1,300%.
Mercedes owns 10% of them. You know, they've got an Apple executive over there now, and the joke is that their screen's bigger than any Apple iPod, but iPad, I mean. But, you know, if Mercedes is the logical buyer, but, you know, Mr. Musk is a very feisty fellow, but he's a brilliant PR guy. And at that price, I would certainly sell, but most companies won't pay that price to buy. So I think there'll be more of a joint venture. And I would be shocked. No one's going to buy them out at these valuations. It just doesn't make sense. But it is a good car. You know, one caught on fire in Seattle recently, but it got in a wreck. But the car did tell the person to exit the car, so that was nice of it. I have a car with lithium batteries in it. You just can't penetrate the batteries. It's simple as that. They're hot, and that's why the car burned up. And then at least they've had the good batteries. You know, some of the other cars had bad batteries, but you know, Porsche, Tesla, Nissan, they all are using the good lithium batteries. They come from Samsung, and they're the ones that make the best.
No, I think that's also another sector. We don't have time for that today, maybe in a future episode or installment, but definitely the solar industry, as I'm sure you know, one of the hottest, if not the hottest sector for quite some time, and we've been following several that have just been moving exponentially that were late to the party. Well, Mr. Navalier, we want to thank you for your comments today and wish you continued success, sir.
Great. Well, I appreciate it. Thanks again.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show the best-selling author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad book series, Robert Kiyosaki. Welcome back.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I love talking to you guys.
You know, let's begin, if we could, with the psychology of winning. You've delved into this matter in some detail in recent years, and no matter how successful one is, one can always use some improvement. Please tell folks how to change their mindset and outlooks to maybe that of more of a winning posture.
I can talk about money, you know, because and I don't win at everything in life, obviously, but with money I like to win. And I like to start there's four kinds of people in the world on any subject. And one is the person who must win. The second type of person is the person who must be right. And they don't always win, simply because they get stuck at being right. The third type of person is a person who must be liked, and another person is a person who must be comfortable. So depending upon the subject, like let's take working out at the gym. My battle is I like to be comfortable. So I don't win too much there. And, you know, being liked and being right are not consequential. So a lot has to do with the subject. And when it comes to the subject of money, I like to win, not because of money, but simply because one of the reasons I speak to Gold Seek Radio is, as you know, the economy is in very, very dire straits. And there's a lot of people who are comfortable, you know, they say, well, the government will take care of me. And then you have all the politicians who want to be liked, you know, arguing about who's right and who's wrong. And meanwhile, those who are just getting rich, you know, the guys who are winning the game. For the listeners today, relative to the subject of money, you know, where are you? Are you the person who must win? Are you the person who must be right? Are you the person who must be comfortable or the person who must be liked? And when I kind of address people, I can almost tell who they are. Like I have a couple of friends who, nicest people on earth, you know, really like, they like you, they like them. They don't win in money by winning, they win by being likable. They just want to be liked, you know? And then there's those who are just comfortable. They say, well, you know, I don't have to worry about it. Government will take care of me. There's no sense talking to them about winning because they've already got their mind made up. And then those guys who are, you know, just trying to shut down the government and all this, or, you know, Republicans versus Democrats. So they're the guys that must be right. And I don't really want to listen to them. I just want to win. Does that kind of answer your question?
Wasn't exactly what I was looking for, but that's what makes it interesting here on Gold Seek Radio. You know, you've also gone on record saying that you're not a big fan of the fiat money system. You've got a lot of good company here with the guests on the show. You say you just don't trust much of anything but gold and silver.
Well, you know, I think the sad part is when you look at the people who must be liked and must be comfortable, they have no idea what fiat money means. You know, they're the guys just happy to get a paycheck. So with that said, you know, the reason they're going to be the biggest losers is because they don't know the difference between money. And I'm getting less and less optimistic about the future, but you have to keep an open mind. So pretty soon the government has to start printing in mass. I mean, they're only printing $1 trillion a year right now, but they will start printing more because very simply they can't handle Social Security, Medicare, all the for the people that must be comfortable. They can't. If they stiff those people, we'll have anarchy. If you finally say to these people, you know, you won't get your food stamps, they go, what? And then we'll have Syria and Egypt and all that, the rioting. So that's what's going to happen.
You know, it's funny you should mention this. I think it's very appropriate, given that tomorrow, Friday, November 1st, with potential civil unrest, if we look at the EBT SNAP card program, there's going to be about a 5.5% cut across the board nationwide. And this is one of the things that we've been talking about here on the show this week, and this is a little known fact, not being reported on the mainline media. There will be millions of people whose cards will simply no longer be usable because they're no longer reaching that threshold for their food stamp cards. So I guess the question for you is, are you expecting some blowback tomorrow?
Well, you know, thank you for telling me because I wasn't aware of that. You know, that's, you know, my food stamp card is, well, is very good. That's not one of those government programs I monitor too closely. I monitor other things. But anyway, I don't know what's going to happen. You know, I was a little late coming to the phone because I was loading up on food. I'm storing food all over the place. You know, I have five houses, so every house I'm stored up for a year. It's because I don't know if it's civil unrest or those EMPs or, you know, nuclear war or whatever. Food is going to be a major problem. And, you know, I went to military school and we studied, you know, what causes revolution. And we studied Castro versus Che Guevara. And, you know, after the Cuban Revolution, Che Guevara went into, I think, Bolivia. And he thought, oh, this is ripe for revolution. You know, the peasants are ready to revolt. And so he was out there, and he finally died in Bolivia. But he could never get the peasants to revolt. And the reason the peasants did not revolt was they were too well fed. And so is that as Jim Rogers, the guy who told me this, you know, he says the food prices are so high now that they get hungry and they get angry. And then when people are hungry and angry, then an agitator like, you know, the Arab Spring or Al-Qaeda or Hamas will come in and just whip them into a lather. So what I have found from my military background is that it's hunger that really gets people off their butts.
That's what we're reading, that the one common factor that seems to crop up every time there's civil unrest is a lack of food or expensive produce at the grocery store. We've seen this time and again in Egypt, I'm sure you'll recall, as well as Zimbabwe. One of the reasons why the mainline media is missing this big event that I'm expecting, in fact, I'm warning my subscribers as soon as tonight, I'll be warning my subscribers to watch out for civil unrest anywhere a grocery store is located tomorrow, because I think people forget that we have 50 million people who would otherwise be in soup kitchens or bread lines wrapped around every major metropolitan area. And that would, I think, shock even the people who lived through the Great Depression, who saw the actual soup kitchens and bread lines. And the reason why we don't see those things yet, although I think we're going to see it starting as soon as next week, is that we've had this food stamp program that's sort of picked up the slack, if you will. I think that system's about to fall apart here.
Well, I hope you're wrong, but I think you're right.
You can buy these 5-gallon Mylar bags. Take an iron and they seal right up with an oxygen bag in it. You can store food for 20, 30 years in these things. Insects can't get to them. Rodents, for the most part, can't get to them. We're storing food not just because of we're worried about shortages, but we're also concerned about the Fukushima plumes hitting the United States, North America, even the Northern Hemisphere. We're getting reports of very contaminated food. And it's a big problem on the West Coast, as well as in Japan and Alaska. And it, once again, it's flying under the radar screen of a lot of folks. Any thoughts there?
I've never heard of that one, but it verifies my actions. You know, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm just being a Boy Scout and just being prepared. You know, I should have, would have, could have, you know.
Folks are being vilified and ostracized in this country for simply taking some obvious measures.
So that's why, as I said, I was late because I was storing food. I was at the local guy in town here. He was a hero on the TV show Preppers, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, our favorite show.
Yes, I go, and I was at his shop, and I spent a fortune again. And you know, all it is a very high-end Army-Navy surplus store for yuppies.
You know, you should be on one of those episodes. I bet they'd love to have you on there.
Well, I tell you what, after I had him on one of my radio programs, his name is Tim Ralston, and after talking, this was a year ago, and since then, you know, I've bought 2 acres of very remote land you can't get to. It's got, I live in Arizona, so the most precious thing in Arizona is water. Remote, and I just moved in last week. You know, I got my ammunition, my guns, my food, and, you know, my wife thinks I'm gone wacko, but I said, you know, I'd rather just not think about it. I don't want to be right or wrong. You know what I mean? I just want to win. If nothing happens, then nothing happens.
But Noah's wife probably thought he was nuts too.
Yeah, and you know, like it took me 5 days to get everything moved into that cabin. Now imagine if something happens like instantaneously. You don't have 5 days to get out of town and into the mountains. If it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, it doesn't. And she says, well, everybody's going to think you're strange. They already think I'm strange. I mean, she'll see my builder. You know, I say, okay, I want a steel door here. He goes, why? I said, don't ask me why. I'm going to pay you to put a steel door here. Isn't this door good enough? I said,
I'm contacting the Doomsday folks today and putting in a request for Robert Kiyosaki on the next season of Doomsday Preppers.
You know, I mean, in 1997, I wrote Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and I said, your house is not an asset. And I said, savers will be losers. And I got hammered for that. And then in 2007, you know, the real estate market plummets and all this. And, you know, savers are finally going, well, why can't I save any money? I said, well, because inflation's killing you. But I also explained that there's assets and liabilities, and that's really what it was about. So my house in the mountains a liability, but it's going to be an asset if I have to run. So anyway, you know, I mean, who knows who's right and wrong? I just grow more pessimistic every day, and that's the. But also at the same time, you got to be an optimist. Also, and I'm very excited because I think it's really going to be a good time for those who are prepared. Let me get there's 3 levels of preparedness, right? Well, 4 levels. One is people who have no idea what's going on; they don't care. The second level are the preppers, you know, they're survivalists.
Only about 3 million people right now in the U.S.
Yeah, that's what they're survivalists. And then there's the thrivers. And the thrivers who are now, they're up in Arizona, we have a lot of them. They're little towns that people are banding together, and they're going to block the roads, and they're going to do all that stuff. But they're going to thrive. You know, they're going to have food, and they have friends, and they have shelter, and they got weapons.
I've got a series for you. Did you ever by chance see Skeet Ulrich on hit TV show Jericho? You're describing an episode right out of this series, probably about 30 to 50 episodes. You won't be able to turn it off when you find it. It's available on Amazon.com. It's available on Netflix. This is a must for all the preppers in our audience, which has got to be about half of this audience. You've just described it. They locked down the whole town, and people still constantly tried to break into the town and take everything they had.
It's your neighbors who you got to watch out for. So there's kind of 3 levels. One is survive, one is thrive, one is prosper. And I plan on prospering. So I'm not, you know, I just want to get the other 2 bases covered.
What about American Blackout? I bet you just saw the National Geographic hit TV show where it essentially shows the entire U.S. grid down, probably due to an EMP blast, as you mentioned earlier. Do you have solar panels? Do you have generators in place?
No, I mean, I haven't seen that movie.
I'll forward a link to your assistant there. And this is the entire movie free on YouTube. Who knows how long it'll last. They'll probably pull it soon. But it probably was their top documentary. It's a docudrama. It shows 5 or 6 families trying to survive with no electricity for about two, 2 to 3 weeks in the United States, and the blogosphere is abuzz on this docudrama.
I'm not prepared to that level.
It wouldn't cost you that much. You know, I've got, we picked up 10 solar panels, 100-watt solar panels, a few deep-cycle batteries, and a simple charger from China. You know, I mean, instead of $800, you can get them now on eBay for $50. Just for a couple $1,000s, you can have a good sound little backup that'll give you a computer, TV, internet, keep a hot plate, you know, and things of that nature.
Now, the thing that I put my money into are machine guns and ammunition.
I don't have enough stuff to need machine gun and ammunition.
I was a Marine in Vietnam, and you don't want to go to a gunfight without a machine gun, as they say.
Right.
Well, they're pretty exciting, so they just keep hammering it out there.
Right. Well, you know, you've got competition there. The Department of Homeland Security just purchased a billion rounds of hollow point ammunition, several tanks, and armored personnel carriers. So they're expecting some unrest, and a lot of folks are pointing to, once again, tomorrow with the SNAP card situation.
Wow, I didn't know that. You know, I've been a wacko now since probably 1983. I could talk to my wife because I met her in 84, and she said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Look, I'm just getting out of Dodge," and she didn't know why. But I read a book called The Grunch of Giants by Dr. R. Buckminster Fuller in 1983. A very small book. And I reread it in 2007, and it's just like nothing's changed. The same thing's going on.
You know, Dr. Fuller was the creator of the Buckyball as well as the geodesic dome like Epcot Center in Florida.
And also the U.S. Pavilion at the Expo 67 Worlds. Now, I was a student of his, so every time I listened to him, you know, I was going, holy mackerel. And so when I met my wife in 84, you know, she really could. I said, "Look, I'm just getting out of Dodge. I can't do what I'm doing anymore." And that's when I started teaching, because I could see this crisis coming.
I didn't start to see this until after 9/11. That was my wake-up call, and I've been pounding the table ever since. So you were more than 20 years ahead of most folks. And I think a lot of people just gave up on this doomsday talk when they saw that the year 2000 bug didn't come to pass. But
the Y2K.
Yes, Y2K, exactly. I think that disappointed a lot of folks, and it kind of became stigmatized. But that's changing.
Well, I should hope so. I mean, you know, the worst is coming within the next 5 years. I'm afraid we're going to collapse from one thing or the other, but we will collapse. There's no way of preventing it right now.
Yeah, the U.S. dollar agrees with you. We're seeing considerable breakdown there. It had every chance to rally for 3 years in a row. And there's considerable technical weakness in the U.S. dollar, the greenback now struggling against the euro in particular. And that, I think, is an ominous sign that may indicate really serious political, geopolitical, and economic strife here in the U.S.
Well, if you read that book, it's a late book out called Currency Wars by Jim Rickards.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a fabulous book to read, because it's not just the U.S. dollar. It's called The Race to the Bottom, where every country wants to devalue their dollar just so they can kind of bankrupt their neighbors, but they also bankrupt the citizenship, their own citizens. So Rickard's book, Currency Wars, very good reading. I interviewed him yesterday, and he was not optimistic, per se.
No, I can imagine.
But I think the biggest thing I could warn people is from my indications, the people in the stock market, you know, the guys have 401ks and IRAs full of stocks, bonds, and mutual funds, they're the next target. They're going to get wiped out. You know, because the last target was 2007. It was the homeowners. Now they're going to get the retirement plans.
No, I think you're right. I think, you know, with rehypothecation, the wake-up call, the warning signal, the shot across the bow was clearly the MF Global fiasco, as well as Cyprus there in Europe. I think those two events, then, of course, the government of Poland took the entire populace and lifted them upside down and emptied half of their pension pocketbooks without any promise, you know, for future repayment. So, I mean, I think the writing's on the wall, but folks are too busy just trying to get through the business day to pay much attention to what's going on.
Yeah, they're watching the Jerry Springer show.
They're too busy watching American Idol or what have you. But, you know, but there are some folks waking up, and that's why, you know, we're trying to get the message out there. So as we wind down this interesting discussion, I wonder if you could give people your outlook on the precious metals. I forgot to mention it. My guess is you're still accumulating after about 30 years.
Right. What I got rid of were my precious metal ETFs, because I don't trust paper anymore. And I stuck with all my hard assets. I think the good thing, I'll just give the good news for people. If you're prepared, you'll actually do better. For example, when I saw this crisis coming, about 1997, I started buying gold and silver like a wild man. And back then, gold was, I think, $295 an ounce or something. And so when people say, well, how do you feel about it coming down? I said, I'm still up $1,000. Give me a break. And then my machine guns keep going up because you can't build another machine gun.
I'd like to know what asset you're holding that's up 3-4-fold. There's not too many stocks, unless you were just one of those lucky Google shareholders. Apple, one of these companies, most people long since sold their shares, they were shaken out. In the final analysis, it really protects your purchasing power, precious metals.
Well, I think you should get some, definitely. I think there's 11 years worth of silver left. So when you get that kind of stat, I think there's about 14 of gold out of the ground. So when you look at that, and then the cost of mining gold today is around $1,100 an ounce, depending on where you're mining it. So even at 13, you're giving a $200 premium on it.
Well, I just read an article that claims that there's only 1 billion ounces of silver above ground, whereas 30 to 40 years ago, there used to be 20 to 30 billion ounces of silver, whereas now there's 6 or 7 billion ounces of gold, which means there's actually several-fold more gold in reserves above ground. But the catch is that there's a considerable amount of silver mined each year, but now they're claiming that 1 billion ounces in production annually is being consumed at the pace that it's coming out of the ground.
Well, it's always been consumed, and that's why there's only 12 years left, I think.
No, you're exactly right. Reclaiming the silver and gold in cell phones, as well as system boards on computers and virtually any other electronic product, you can take a cell phone apart and that little keypad that has the gold on it, I mean, that is a considerable amount of 18 to 24 karat gold you can send in for a few dollars or take down to your local scrap yard.
Well, I think that's the point. It's not doom and gloom. It's actually doom and boom. If you're prepared for it, you're going to do very well. Now, you should have a gun in the meantime, but other than that, I'm a former Marine. I did 2 tours in Vietnam, and it doesn't do much good.
Well, you need to have...
But anyway, the whole point here is this, is that you can do very well if you prepare for it, but I would be very concerned about being in the stock market.
Although I wouldn't be surprised if they don't continue this monetary stimulus for the next few months, at least until the end of Dr. Bernanke's tenure there at the Federal Reserve. So we might even surprise folks on the long side. I wouldn't go too heavily into bearish funds at this point, bearish ETFs. I'd watch the market carefully before that. But I do agree with you, the end game here is not going to be pretty.
No, I think, I don't think we've got a few, we don't have many years left. So that's why I speak to you guys, and I've been preparing this since 83. I think if people read Dr. Fuller's book called The Grunch of Giants, R. Buckminster Fuller, and if you can read it, he's pretty hard to read, it's a very small book, but you'll say nothing has changed. And instead of Obama, there's Reagan, and instead of Bernanke, there's Volcker. That's the only difference.
The same dogmas and ideologies.
He mentions Glass-Steagall, he mentions Eisenhower warning of us with the military-industrial complex and all this. And basically what it is the heist of the U.S. government. And that's what's happened. The Fed is not federal, it's a cartel of international bankers.
You know, I listened to an interesting character yesterday who referred to the Federal Reserve. He said it's no more federal than Federal Express.
Yeah, that's a good saying. I would say that's true. And I always ask the question, who pays Bernanke his... Who signs Bernanke's paycheck? Nobody really knows. And that's why I go, who's paying it? Who's Bernanke hopefully knows something.
1913, the Fed's tenure year, about 100 years, and they've essentially ruined the U.S. dollar. And some people believe that they've transferred most of the wealth offshores. And apparently 10 foreign banks own the Federal Reserve, and they're not known for the most part. We don't know who owns our Federal Reserve, and that's against the Constitution of the United States.
That's correct. Kind of the good news is, let's talk about records, of currency wars. He says the gold is stored in New York. That's why when the Germans wanted their gold back, they said, wait 7 years.
Well, Robert Kiyosaki, we want to thank you for your thoughts today and continued success.
Thank you for having me on your program. I appreciate it.
Well, Mike. Michael Maloney is the founder and owner of GoldSilver.com, a global leader in gold and silver sales. Author of the best-selling precious metals investment book of all time, it's a pleasure to welcome Michael Maloney.
Well, thank you for having me on your show.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you back. And let's begin, if we could, with fiat currencies. You say all paper money schemes eventually end in the same fashion, collapse and inflation. I wonder if you could please tell us why you expect the U.S. dollar perhaps to follow in, the steps of its predecessors.
Well, there are some fiat currencies that were just basically abandoned. But when that happens also, it still goes to pretty much infinity price for everything. So they all go to zero. That's a fact. But not all of them end in hyperinflation. But we've tried this hundreds of times throughout history where we expand the currency supplies to stimulate growth. And what it does is distorts the economy, creates a wealth transfer, and ends up causing a lot of pain in the end. It always ends in disaster. There isn't a single example in all of history of this working out.
You know, not a single incident in history where this essentially ended well, particularly for the hoi polloi, you know, for the bourgeois, for the everyday folks. I mean, we essentially get caught holding the fiat currency bag.
Exactly. The distortion of the economy. See, when you create a new unit of currency, it doesn't actually contain any economic energy. It's neutral, basically sterile. Somebody spends it into circulation, and what it does is rob purchasing power from all the other sectors of the economy. So it pushes one sector into a bubble while it's causing prices to rise in other sectors, meaning people confuse rising prices with gains. It's actually a loss in purchasing power of the currency. So when an asset class rises very fast, that's inflation. You get inflation of real estate. You know, one of the things, every dollar goes somewhere. And when they talk about the CPI index and things like that, when they talk about inflation, I like to use the like Milton Friedman's definition of inflation. It's an expansion or a contraction of the currency supply, as inflation and deflation. Every dollar goes somewhere. So whenever they create excess currency, it inflates something. It's just that there's different waves and cycles, and currency takes the path of least resistance always, the place where it's going to get the most gains. It either inflates the stock markets, or it inflates savings accounts, or it inflates retail prices. But whenever they create currency, it does create inflation. And one of the things that people don't realize, we do not use money. We use currency. There is no country on the planet that uses money currently. My first episode of Hidden Secrets of Money is all about the difference between currency and money. And basically, currency has to be a medium of exchange, a unit of account. It's got to be portable, durable, divisible, something called fungible, where the units are all interchangeable. If I borrow a 20 from you, I can pay you back a 10, a 5, and 5 ones, and you're happy. So that interchangeability is fungibility. Money has to be all of those things plus a store of value. And so people need to stop calling the stuff in their wallet money. We don't have a money supply. We have a credit supply and a currency supply. And these definitions are extremely important.
Particularly appreciate the nuance of real money in circulation. You know, I think that we forget as Americans that for, let's say, 100 years, we actually still had the remnants of real money in circulation, even up until, let's say, just a few years ago, one could find silver, dimes, quarters, halves.
Real money is the enemy of fiat currency. It can destroy a fiat currency and cause the fiat currency to go to zero. So politicians always have to pass some sort of law if they want to get away with spending fiat currency and being able to make promises that they can't afford to keep without imposing the inflation tax on us, a stealth tax that the public doesn't see. If they want to promise all this, these free goodies that aren't really free, they have to pass some sort of laws to get rid of real money. You know, fiat currency, like I said, it distorts the economy, it causes bubbles. So for the savvy investor that sort of knows what's going on and the people that are good with playing with credit and so on, it's a benefit. They win at everybody else's expense. Like I said, the inflation tax, I was interviewing Steve Forbes a few months ago. One of the things he brought up that I'd never even thought of before was who made the Federal Reserve the fourth branch of government? Who allowed them the power to impose a they're targeting 2 or 3% inflation. That is their target. In other words, they're saying they're going to impose a 2 or 3% tax across the board for everybody in the United States. That's a power that the government is only supposed to have.
No, it sure is. And, you know, if we look back over its 100-year tenure beginning in 1913, most sources indicate that we have lost roughly 96% of the purchasing power of the greenback over that 100-year period. Here at its centennial birthday, if you will, facing a runaway balance sheet at the Federal Reserve, approaching $4 trillion, on track for $5 trillion as soon as this time next year.
I keep on harping on this in different interviews and stuff, but basically the public does not understand the scale of the emergency that is going on. You know, they did all these bailouts back in 2008, but then they never stopped increasing the currency supply and doing emergency measures. They're right now creating $85 billion per month. So that equals just over $1 trillion per year. Well, in 2008, base money, I call it base currency because it's not money. So the base currency supply was 0.8 trillion. It was less than a trillion. Now they create $1 trillion every year. In other words, it took 200 years, over 200 years, to produce that first 0.8 trillion of the paper dollars that are in your wallet. They produce more than that every single year, and it's just going, this is QE to infinity. When Ben Bernanke came out and said that they weren't going to taper, that was the point where it was all over with. That was an admission that they can never taper. If they can't start to taper off of this life support without crashing the stock market and the economy in 4 years into an economic expansion, then it's just not possible. And every 4 to 5 years, there's a recession. So we're due for a recession in 2014, 2015 at the latest. And what's going to happen then? Janet Yellen will start producing half a trillion a month, a trillion a month, who knows? Basically, the dollar is toast eventually. One of the things that I show in the second episode of Hidden Secrets of Money is that every 30 to 40 years, the world has an entirely different monetary system. It didn't affect the common person on the last transitions. It will during this transition. But before World War I, we had full gold backing. Between the wars, we had partial gold backing and partial debt backing of currencies. Then from 44 to 71, we had the Bretton Woods system where other countries held U.S. dollars in reserve, and then the U.S. dollar was convertible into gold, and foreign central banks only could change their dollars into gold at the New York Fed. And then Nixon closed the gold window in 71, and in doing so, he unwittingly began an experiment that has been proven just hundreds and hundreds of times throughout history to not work. It's always a 100% failure rate. Nixon put the entire world on fiat currencies simultaneously because they were all pegged to gold, but through the U.S. dollar. So when he severed that tie with the U.S. dollar and gold, he severed the tie between all world currencies and gold. And so we began this experiment that, like I said, has throughout history, there is no example of it ever working. It's 100% failure rate.
Now we become accustomed to this QE to infinity, and what we haven't even addressed, the Fed funds rate and overnight lending rate, virtually at zero.
Right. What it means is that they're out of ammunition. What they're doing isn't working. And so when we start to go into a recession, and we really are in one, we never got out of the last one, but when things start getting worse, they're going to triple what doesn't work, and then they're going to quadruple what doesn't work. They're just going to keep on saying, well, since it didn't work, we need to do more of it. And basically, this is the beginning. 2008 was the beginning of the transition to the next monetary system. If you look around the world, my series, Hidden Secrets of Money, and you can see it at hiddensecretsofmoney.com, it shows all of the nails in the coffin for the U.S. dollar standard. Since 71, the world, you know, It was a whole bunch of fortunate accidents for the United States that put us on this global dollar standard where we're the world's reserve currency. We didn't have any wars on our soil, and during World War I and World War II, countries paid us in gold. And by the end of World War II, the U.S. had two-thirds of all the world's gold and three-quarters of all the world's monetary gold, the central bank gold. And so it made us, it's all financial. We became a superpower because of what went on financially behind the scenes of all this war. It wasn't really the war itself that made us the superpower. It was the fact that we had these lucky accidents happen to us that gave us the right to impose a tax on the rest of the world since 1944. If the rest of the world has to hold dollars, and more than half the dollars that exist outside the United States, and we create a new dollar and dilute the currency supply and do some deficit spending with that, it gets its purchasing power by robbing it from all the other dollars in existence, including the ones that reside outside the United States. That's a stealth tax that the rest of the world couldn't see, but they're all waking up to it. If you watch Dollar Crisis to Golden Opportunity, the third episode, you'll see all of these nails in the coffin. And when Nixon put us on the dollar standard in 71, there was a calm before the storm where everything worked just fine until Saddam Hussein started selling oil for euros. And then the nails in the coffin are coming more and more and more quickly. And now there's something happening at least once a month or once a week where another country is turning its back on the U.S. dollar and not wanting to use the U.S. dollar in international trade. And that means that someday all those dollars outside the United States, if they don't have a use for them, they're going to start coming home. We already had a picture of what this looks like when that happens. I don't know if you remember the late 80s when Japan was coming over here and buying up downtown Los Angeles and Rockefeller Center and all of the class, huge inflation, where all of the big skyscraper buildings in, you know, the premium stuff doubled in price very, very quickly. That is basically going to be happening again, except this time it's going to be China coming over here and getting rid of their trillions of U.S. dollars that they've got in reserves.
Well, let's transition, if we could, into just what steps investors can take to convert their paper stocks, bonds, and overvalued assets into physical gold and silver investment vehicles. I understand that you prefer physical gold, as do we. Maybe give some tips to folks and whether or not you shun ETFs.
I absolutely do shun ETFs, but first, I believe that the first step for anybody is to get educated before you take action. Know what you're doing before you do it. And so they should listen to more of the episodes of your radio show, listen and watch everything else that they can find that's similar. My series, Hidden Secrets of Money, is a very in-depth series. It's shot in 16 countries. It has animations that we have two full-time animators that animate complex. Our most recent episode, The Greatest Scam in the History of Mankind, shows how the monetary system works and that it's just a giant Ponzi scheme. And it really is the very first time that people can actually see the whole thing and see how the monetary system itself, just having dollars in existence, steals wealth from the working class and transfers it to the financial sector. It went a million views in 3 weeks. So get educated first. And then the next step, I would say, is to buy physical coins and bars, either in your possession or in a storage account at a third-party depository. I don't like banks and safe deposit boxes. They were closed the week of 9/11, and if you had gold, you couldn't get to it. If you had gold at Brinks or some private, you know, Brinks is not a they don't fall under any banking regulation. A lot of these depositories are basically independent companies. Brinks calls themselves UPS with guns. They're an armored car service. They've got a depository, and they will store for people. We open accounts for our customers at Brinks. That's a very liquid way of maintaining your own coins and bars. And then the third thing would be stocks. Stocks give you leverage, but you take your gambling money for the mining stocks and so on. When it comes to ETFs, with an ETF, you have a share in a trust that is a custodian for some gold, but you don't own the gold. You don't own the silver in that ETF. You're owning a share in a trust, and you are an unsecured creditor. And so you are the last in line if something happens to that company. So, you know, if something does happen, good luck. And what you're also, with an ETF, you can short them. If somebody is short, that means that there are more owners for each ounce than there are ounces. I mean, it's that simple. When somebody borrows an ounce and sells it into the market, then somebody else buys it. So that person owes that ounce back to the original owner, and somebody else also thinks he owns that same ounce. So an ETF, if you're going to get involved with them, before you do, read their prospectus and their Securities and Exchange 10-K filings very carefully before you do, and read it with a very suspicious eye as to how could these people cheat me. And when you do, you're going to discover some clauses in there that basically make it okay for them to not have all the gold or silver that they basically are going to claim they do. These clauses have little twists. They either give it whatever they're saying. If you read the sentence, it'll have a word or two inserted that either give it no meaning, or it gives it two meanings, or it gives it the exact opposite meaning of what it appears to be.
You know, it's ironic you'd mention that our mutual friend and friend of the show here, Robert Kiyosaki, one of the first things he asks when entering into any business deals, as he said many times here on the show, is how will they cheat me? And that's euphemistically said. He would said it more colorful manner. Also wanted to ask you about the gold on the London Exchange. You know, it's re-entered backwardation second time this year. That's only the fourth time in 20 years, and James Turk, a regular on the show, he believes that this has marked the lows in almost every, for instance, 1999 and 2008, backwardation marked the lows on the yellow metal. Are you following this indicator at all, and do you think it could suggest a nadir for the markets?
I really am only interested in the very long-term trends. I don't believe... I am not a gold bug. I'm not attached to gold and silver in any way. I just believe that gold and silver are in their cycle right now, and when they are doing an accounting of the expansion of the fiat currency supply, which they have done, it's already happened twice in the United States, 1934 and the 1970s. Gold rises to account for the expansion of the fiat currency supply. Well, it's happening again. And during these periods, things like the Dow gold ratio, where you take the points on the Dow Jones Industrial Average, divide it by the price of gold, and you get how many ounces of gold each share of the Dow costs. And what you see, if you do a long-term chart on this going back 100 years, is that there are times of a tremendous overvaluation for paper assets and undervaluation for gold and silver. Same thing when you take a look at it, real estate versus gold or silver. Regardless of what the price is, I don't really care what the price goes to. I care how much stuff gold and silver is going to buy. If we're in a deflation and the Dow goes down to 3,000 and gold peaks at 6,000, that means it's half an ounce of gold will buy one share of the Dow. If we go into big inflation and the Dow goes to 30,000, but gold goes to 60,000, it means that half an ounce of gold will buy one share of the Dow. And if we go into hyperinflation and the Dow goes to 30 trillion and gold goes to 60 trillion, it means that half an ounce of gold will buy one share of the Dow. So the price is absolutely inconsequential. I'm looking for how much stuff it purchases. And when you measure gold against both real estate and stocks, it has not completed its cycle yet. We are currently around the area of 12 or so. In other words, it takes 12 ounces of gold to buy one share of the Dow. In 1932, it only took two. In 1980, it only took one. Since we're coming off the biggest bubble of paper assets in all of history and the lowest, you know, we in the year 2000, 2001, that was the biggest undervaluation for gold. It was the lowest value that gold had ever had in 5,000 years. You have to look at the fact that before 71, all currencies on the planet, or the vast majority of them, were somehow connected to gold. There may have been one or two that weren't, but those fail, as we know. At any given time back then, there might have been one or two where they go off of gold and then it eventually implodes. But typically, before 71, currencies were always connected to gold, or gold was our money. And then from 1971, so it's only the past 40 years or so, that the world has done this experiment where no nation on planet back uses gold as money. So there's no monetary demand in the year 2000. And gold had gone into a bubble in 1980 and entered a brutal bear market from 1980 to 2000. By the mid-1990s, investors just started giving up on gold and silver and selling. And so by the year 2000, nobody wanted gold. And when I discovered gold and silver in 2002 and started buying and started telling everybody about it, they'd be going, gold is the worst investment you could put. And I'm trying to get them to buy gold in the low 300s. I was buying at 315 and so on, saying gold has been going down for 20 years. And I'm going, exactly, it's been going down for 20 years. Don't you get it? And so it was almost impossible to get somebody to buy gold back then. But it's definitely not done with its cycle. We are just, this pullback that we've been in for the last couple of years is simply the equivalent of the 1975 pullback in gold, where it went from just under $200 an ounce to $100 an ounce in a 20-month period from the first day of 75 until September of 76. It did a big pullback then. So it's a cyclical bear market within a secular bull market. And, you know, people were asking me, because I've been saying that this would happen during this bull market for years, they were asking me if the pullback in 2008 was it. And I said, no, there was too much demand. This a cyclical bear has to end with everybody giving up on that investment class. It has to be considered sort of a poison investment class. And you're seeing sentiment in gold right now that's very negative. Now, it could go down some more, but if it hasn't put in the bottoms already, it will very soon, and then it's off to the races. But it may have already put in the bottom. You know, in my book, I covered deflation, inflation, things going pretty much just as they are, hyperinflation, and then my favorite scenario that was a roller coaster, a mixture of all of the above. I said that there would be the threat of deflation, to which the Federal Reserve would overreact and do a big helicopter drop, which they did. That was the bailouts in 2008 and the QEs. That would cause a reflation, and we saw that with the stock markets and real estate. And then there would be a real deflation, a contraction of the currency supply. And if you take a look at what's going on with the credit aggregates right now, you can look at John Williams of ShadowStats has an M3 that he compiles. If you take a look at those measurements of the currency supply, but then realize that base money or base currency is a component. And so to see what's happening in the credit portion of those aggregates, you have to deduct base currency. And when you do, you find that there's this huge collapse in credit going on right now. So we are seeing a deflation happening in the credit aggregates, and Ben Bernanke has been almost exactly offsetting that collapse with the growth in base money, base currency.
Well, as this interview wraps up here, are there any other topics you'd like to share with our listeners today?
Urge them to take a look at Hidden Secrets of Money. I think they will really, really enjoy it. It's a very entertaining approach to economics and monetary history, and makes it sort of fun to learn these things. And basically, that there is something enormous waiting out there for us in the future. The greatest wealth transfer in the history of mankind. And for most people, it's going to be a tragedy. But for the people that are smart and learn about this stuff and take action, going to be the best thing that ever happened to them, because if it's the greatest wealth transfer in the history of mankind, that means it's the greatest opportunity in the history of mankind. So take this disaster and turn it around into the best thing that ever happened to you.
Well said. And any other contact information for the listeners today?
GoldSilver.com, where we've got news updated every day, and we offer bullion, coins and bullion, and HiddenSecretsOfMoney.com. Thank you.
Jim Rogers is an author and financial commentator and a successful international investor. It's a pleasure to welcome back Jim Rogers in his Singapore office.
I'm delighted to be here, Chris.
Let's start today with the equities market. And your last appearance on the show, equities were at all-time highs. And last Friday, the Dow Jones closed at the highest point in its history. Clearly, the $85 billion a month in debt purchases by the Fed is a major factor here behind the scenes. You say that you own shares, but you're getting nervous that ultimately this could end badly. What do you think?
Well, I know it's going to end badly when it ends. It means it's going to end anytime soon. You know, all the central banks in the world continue to print money. And it's the Japanese debt, they'll print unlimited amounts of money. And Yankee said he'll print $1 trillion a year, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's not ending yet, but when it does end, Chris, when it does end, it's going to be a mess for all of us. Because, I mean, the world is floating on this unbelievable artificial sea of liquidity, which is pretty staggering when you add up the numbers. But when it ends, I don't know when it's going to end. It's not going to be fun.
Do you think that Dr. Bernanke is handing out stimulus in order to provide a grand exit for himself and maybe a nice transition?
Well, no, I know Bernanke's not going to end it because he doesn't want. He knows what's going to happen when it ends, so he's not about to end it. And the new lady is very keen on money printing, so she's not going to end it. She's certainly not going to come in and the first thing she does is have a disaster on her hands. So no, it's going to continue on for a while. I'm not quite sure what's going to end it. It may be that the market eventually will just force them to end it. But even if the market just says, we're not going to take your paper anymore, the market's not going to take that anytime soon. So neither the market nor the central bankers are ready to end this.
You've gone on record recently noting that the Fed is supposed to prevent economic slowdowns. But, you know, according to the Fed's own data, its civilian employment population ratio is near depression levels. You have nearly 100 million Americans who simply aren't working. They're able-bodied and ready to work. Did the Great Recession truly end, or is that just more government hyperbole?
They would aptly point out that, you know, we still have very high unemployment. Even with the fake numbers, we have a high unemployment. And as you penetrate into the real numbers, you point out that unemployment is high. No, it never ended. The stock market ended, but that's because the stock market went up, but that's because Bernanke and the rest of the central banks in the world printed staggering amounts of money. But the real economy has not done nearly as well as the stock market.
You've noted that the next financial crisis is inevitable and could be far worse than even 2008 with the Great Recession. Who do you believe will be the ultimate victors, or will the entire world suffer in the next recession?
Well, America's the largest economy in the world. If America suffers, everybody suffers. Europe has got big problems. Europe as a whole is an even larger economy than America. So, you know, Europe's going to suffer, America's going to suffer, which means the rest of the world will suffer too.
Gold investors have enjoyed 12 consecutive winning years. It's now in a correction mode. Are you still watching for a 50% retracement from the 1900 peak, similar to what the Goldman Sachs crowd is calling for, about $1,000 on the precious metal?
I don't know if there'll be a 50% correction. I do know that 50% corrections are normal. That's what happens at all markets. It's not unusual at all. So I suspect we might have a 50% correction before it's over. But that's not a prediction. I suspect it will happen, but I'm not buying. I'm certainly not buying at the moment. I think there'll be another chance to buy gold in the future, so I'm not buying at the moment. Whether it gets that 50% or not, I don't know. If it does go that high, I hope I'm smart enough to buy more.
You've also noted that when food shortages occur, war inevitably breaks out. When a major power starts to decline, the burgeoning nations vie for power. Is the stage being set here for another world war?
Oh, yeah, well, that doesn't mean it has to happen anytime soon, Chris. No, we're certainly setting the stage for another war. America's going deeper and deeper into debt, and it's certainly, if nothing else, a struggle for power. With China on the rise, there's going to be some kind of conflict somewhere, but it may not happen for decades. It doesn't have to happen anytime soon. But it's certainly going to happen. Unfortunately, we've not outlawed war at all. War's been around for thousands of years, and I wish we could outlaw it, but I'm afraid we cannot.
You know, the U.S. dollar has been suffering in recent months. Some folks are calling for perhaps a retest of the all-time lows on the greenback. Do you concur with this notion? And if so, what do you think it could mean for the markets?
I expect more currency turmoil in the future, and I suspect people will go to the U.S. dollar when there's currency turmoil because they don't know what else to do. I actually own U.S. dollar at the moment, and I don't have any confidence in the long-term future of the U.S. dollar. It's going to disappear in the long term. But in the meantime, I own it because I expect more currency turmoil coming, and people will flee to the dollar, rightly or wrongly. Wrongly, in my view, but that's what they're going to do. So I own the dollar as a result. Well, Chris, you're exactly right. Longer term, the dollar is going to, it's going to disappear. We're printing it as fast as we can. We're debasing it. All paper money is being debased, but especially the U.S. dollar, and America's the largest debtor nation in the history of the world. This cannot continue. Never has in history, anyway.
As we wrap up here today, I wonder if you could tell folks what you're watching for. You tend to be several months ahead of the curve here.
Probably the most important thing going on in the world right now is in China. The Chinese government is having its big meeting. It's a plenary session, as they call it. And they're going to announce what they're going to do in the Chinese economy for the next 10, 20, 30 years. In 1978, this conference led to Deng Xiaoping opening the Chinese economy, which has certainly been the most important thing in the last 35 years. 1993, they had another one that had gigantic consequences. They say that this one's going to be as important as the one in 1978 and 1993. I obviously have no clue what they're going to do, but I'm watching it very closely, Chris, because whatever they do, it's going to send a signal to some industries. Some industries are going to receive a lot of money and a lot of incentives when the Chinese decide what to do. And that's going to have a big effect on various companies, various stocks, China and outside of China. So I'm watching carefully. I hope we'll know by the end of the week or early next week. It's going to be it's going to be more important than whatever the central banks do in the world are certainly going to be more important for some industries than even what the central banks do. So keep an eye on China.
Jim Rogers, we want to thank you so much today for taking time from your busy schedule for us.
My pleasure, Chris. Anytime. Thank you.
My next guest requires no introduction. For decades as a congressman on Capitol Hill, Dr. Ron Paul battled for individual liberties and rights. He's now continuing the struggle with the pen and the microphone with his latest book and radio show. Welcome, Dr. Paul.
Well, thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
In your latest Freedom Report, you say that news of the next chairman of the Federal Reserve System has received high praise from Wall Street. But in reality, it really doesn't matter who maybe takes over at the helm. The $85 billion money printing spree per month will continue, with the Fed balance sheet now approaching $4 trillion, on track for $5 trillion as soon as this time next year.
Well, my point was that things will continue, whether you change the chairman or not. I poked fun at him and said that my choice for the Fed chairman was NODA, that is none of the above, because I don't like the Fed and doesn't make a whole lot of difference. But there have been others that point out that maybe there is a little bit difference between Summers and Yellen. If it is, it only means that Yellen is a more likely to inflate and print more money than Summers might have had, if there is such a thing as printing more than $85 billion a month. But I suspect that she is going to pursue the same silly arguments about monetary easing. We'll continue it. She certainly won't slow it up. She's going to make it probably worse.
A frightening thought. And you also point out that by continually printing money, the Fed tampers with the natural rhythm of the economic cycle. That's what economist Joseph Schumpeter referred to as creative destruction. A simple analogy, I think, is a controlled forest fire where rangers deliberately burn undergrowth to prevent a full-scale blaze. Similarly, without allowing credit to contract, businesses to fail, inevitably this economic landscape could become a raging inferno.
What seems to be a benefit is actually a hindrance. They say, well, we kept it from getting worse, but no, they've just delayed the inevitable and made the problem that much greater. What seems so strange to me, at least from the free market viewpoint, is that we're asking for a correction. We think when the Federal Reserve and Congress distorts things, and they work together, they spend too much money and the Fed accommodates, that when it gets grossly out of whack, we should get it back in order. So they're always fighting the market. The market wants the correction. So it's a shame that correction has such a bad name to it, because nobody wants to correct it. Correction should be a good thing. If I'm taking care of a patient and they're doing something wrong, I want to correct it, even though it may bother that individual maybe to eat less or exercise more. In the marketplace, they don't want to have the correction, because politically it's not acceptable, you know, to actually be frugal or spend less or save money and work harder. That's not acceptable these days. Everybody believes that you can create wealth out of a printing press. And in some ways, we in this country have been able to get away with this because we have been very wealthy. We're very powerful militarily. We've had the reserve currency of the world. But I think it's all deception. And the longer it goes on, the greater the danger.
You know, I think it's a great point. By exporting our inflation through essentially printing of dollars as the reserve currency in the petrodollar scenario there, we really have had this amazing luxury for 30, 40 years where profligacy was acceptable and personal responsibility was just less appropriate. But I think that's changing. There's a sea change headed this way.
If there wasn't a change, it would mean that Americans wouldn't have to work because, you know, we could just print the money and everybody would accept it. But we know that's not the case, and we know there are subtle changes right now. You know, they're not gobbling up mortgage debt anymore, and the Fed has the responsibility to buy most of it, most treasury debt and mortgage debt. So it's slowly changing. And I was just looking today at, the interest rates, and I really think the bond markets have taken a change, and interest rates have started up, although slowly. And that'll be a big event, you know. If rates keep creeping up, and then people get very worried about the lasting value of a bond, and nobody buys them, and people realize what's going on, we're going to see higher interest rates, and the Fed won't have. Right now, they have some type of control over it. You know, they can manipulate interest rates when things are going. They can lower rates, make rates lower than people anticipate. But eventually, they'll lose that, and I think we may be approaching that time.
You know, in a recent article, you discussed the new government concept of chained CPI. That's to measure the effect of inflation on people's standards of living. And essentially, the process involves substitution, where higher prices just aren't such a big problem when you can simply substitute a healthy meal with a greasy meal at a fast food restaurant. You say that this is a sleight of hand designed to trick the everyday folks, we the people, by claiming prices are low. Social Security payments are much lower. That helps out the government. You know, instead of letting them eat cake, perhaps the new slogan should be let them eat hamburgers.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, this is not something brand new for governments. I think governments have lied and deceived us in many ways. They certainly have done that in the monetary system. Just look at how long they lied to us about the true conversion value of the dollar in gold. You know, for many, many years, they were able to say, well, the dollar is as good as gold, and it's at $35 an ounce. And they did that for decades. And the psychology, was able to go along with it, you know, after World War II. But finally, those who predicted in the 60s that would break down, they surely did. But they will deceive and lie and try to fudge no matter what they do. But eventually, you know, the truth comes out, because I speak a lot around the country, and a lot of, you know, even during the time I was in the presidential campaign, the audience, especially the elderly in the audience, they knew that the prices were going up more than 1.8%, and that's just there to deceive the people that the QE can continue and it's not harmful. And on the short run, they fool people. On the long run, they can't.
You know, after 12 consecutive winning years, gold continues to struggle this year. But one wonders just how long this trend can persist. The much maligned digital currency, Bitcoin, crossed $400. If digital money, you know, this intangible money, can soar 100-fold in just a few months as an alternative to this crumbling fiat currency system, how high will real tangible money like gold and silver fly when the fiat money loses its global stranglehold?
It's going to go up a lot. I don't think anybody can predict the exact amount, and it depends on what happens when it starts going up. But when you think not too many years ago it was $200, went up as much as $800, and it's still very, very high. That's a high percentage increase. So it's it depends on what we do. If we straighten up our act, maybe they can get under control. But if not, so often what happens, you know, all they can do is print the money, and they think we're immune from that. But if we get in that, then it's infinity. You know, everybody gets out of the dollar rather quickly. What they don't realize is how quickly that can go. The end stages go very, very rapidly. Greenspan, in his new book, made the comment. He says, I talked to so-and-so, and everybody was looking at it, and these were real experts, and nobody knew there was a crisis coming. And I thought, well, he didn't talk to some hard money people. He didn't talk to the free market economists, because there were plenty. There wasn't just one or two of us out there talking about it. But that's what his argument is. Nobody could conceivably know this, and it didn't have anything to do with the monetary system.
You know, the debt ceiling and government shutdown set a dangerous precedent recently. Few Americans, I think, understand that the debt limit was not actually reestablished. It was delayed until the new year, and there is currently no limit on the national debt. And I'd like to know what you think this portends for us.
I think this is one of the biggest events and the biggest issue that came out of that closing down of the government, because in theory it's no limits up until February 15th. Of course, they were making up for past debt increases, because they sort of nominally froze the debt, but they were still spending it, so they've caught up with it, and it's added $800 billion, and they're going to keep doing it, and they'll add on plenty. But the whole thing is, on February 15th, you don't go back to automatic controls. The Congress has to act. The Congress has to pass a law to reclaim their authority. And if the president vetoes the bill, you know, to reclaim the congressional authority over the deficit, the bill doesn't pass, and then you'd have to override it. So essentially, it's been canceled. So we may never see a debt limit return. Now, that should be, of course, frightening to the markets. That should, scare a few people. It should be very, very strong for gold. But we do know that events don't immediately translate into price changes and stock markets. It takes time, and there's a lot of mob psychology in there. But when the time comes, if these events are delayed, then they're more they're of greater consequence when they do hit. They can delay it, but then it comes and it's excessive.
Well, you know, it really was a wake-up call to one agency. China's top debt ratings agency, you may have read, recently downgraded the U.S. Treasury from A to A-. And now that I think that this traditional risk-free investment is no longer, as you might say, risk-free, one wonders how long it's going to be before investors wake up to the only truly risk-free investments, gold and silver.
Well, it's I'm sure, you know, there's a lot of people been selling gold, and gold prices are down, but there's also a lot of people buying gold. So I'm just wondering if somebody studies those international statistics, it just may well be the Chinese that's buying that up, and there's evidence that that is happening. They mine a lot of gold, and they even import gold, so they're saving it. I think they're going to be an economic power. And of course, there's a lot of Chinese bashing in Washington. It was very popular to blame the Chinese. I mean, they're not the greatest free market country in the world, but to blame them for our problems and saying, well, they want to be labeled currency manipulator. Well, what are we? You know, that's what the Fed's job is, to manipulate the currency. But there's a lot of people in Congress would like to blame the Chinese, but I think they're speaking out, and I think most of us know where they stand, and I think they are in the business of accumulating gold, and when everybody discovers that, then you're going to see a sudden turnaround.
Well, you know, I'd liken it to IBM bashing that upstart Microsoft about 15, 20 years ago. It was inevitable. If IBM, i.e. the U.S. government, had perhaps taken their cue from the upstart, you know, maybe they could have sidestepped a lot of economic carnage down the road. I also wanted to ask your thoughts on the growing trend of gold repatriation. Now, this is an interesting story here. Several European countries started the trend of demanding their leased and stored gold back from Fort Knox, New York, and London. And the idea seems to be gaining some momentum. Mexico and Venezuela also made similar requests. Venezuela got all their gold back before Hugo Chavez's untimely death there. And your adopted state of Texas asked the Fed for its gold reserves. Any thoughts here?
Yeah, I think it's a sign of the times. I think it's very, very important, but I don't think it's yet been discounted to the market. Most people are ignoring it, but those of us who have noticed what's going on, I think that we're going to be on the right side of that, because the fact that we didn't give Germany their gold back when they asked for it, it might take 7 years to get it, that should be a huge event. And yet, nothing really happened. Then it raises the question of what does the federal government actually hold? What's at Fort Knox? What does the Federal Reserve have? And they never permit a true audit. So I'd like to say to them what they say to so many of us: if you don't have anything to hide, why can't we investigate what you're doing? But the one big difference is they have no right to know what we're doing. We have every obligation to know what they're doing and tell us what they have in the bank.
Well said. You know, another disturbing theme as we wrap up here affecting investors today is the threat of bail-ins. You know, governments, institutions are including stealthy clauses in the paperwork that redefines, I think, financial confiscation. Should Americans be concerned of a Cyprus-like or maybe MF Global-like rehypothecation or confiscation scenario?
Well, I think so. I don't think we're on the verge of that, but that's the trend of countries. They will confiscate. They'll make you buy certain things, or they'll take your pension funds. That is commonplace. They'll have capital controls. I think we've seen hints of that. So the government, the state itself, along with the central banks, they will do whatever they believe is in their interest, and they will always say, well, we're doing it for the poor people. And if you believe that, you believe the bailouts helped all the poor people, and the wealthy who were taking advantage of the system, they didn't get any bailouts. So it's part of the system, and we should be prepared for it. And it's, you know, a lot of people don't think about it. They have more other things to worry about, and they don't pay much attention to it. But I think ultimately that will come, and it's probably started to a small degree already.
Any other topics we've missed today that you'd like to comment on?
Well, not in particular, other than the fact I think Washington is totally out of control. The spending is going to continue, and they're going to continue to weaken the dollar. And as far as I'm concerned, looking at the value of the dollar and purchasing power and looking at interest rates are probably the two things that we have to watch carefully to see the big turnaround.
Could you tell folks about your latest book as well as any other online contact information?
The best thing is to go to ronpaulmd.com. I have a new website, web page for personal information and all the things that I'm doing, and I have a book out on homeschooling. I'm very interested in education long term, whether it's working with the Mises Institute in college-age kids studying, but I think also the educational system is in shambles, and the book talks about the mess public schools are in, and offering up a curriculum where people might get a real education.
Well, Dr. Paul, we really appreciate your time today. We know you're very busy, and we want to wish you continued success, sir.
Thank you, Chris.